Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Karen Can Radio Show. The intention of this show is to empower and inspire you to manifest the life of your dreams, whether it's radiant health, prosperity, loving relationships, or simply peace of mind. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Can, author of the number one bestseller, Guide to Healing Chronic Pain, A Holistic Approach. And if you don't have a copy of my book, you can get an excerpt absolutely free on my website, www.karencan.com. And when you put your name, email, address in to get on my mailing list, then you'll get a link with the excerpt to the book that you can download, as well as 5 of my Fast Track Your Healing webinar classes, absolutely free. And you can access those at any time. And then check us out on Facebook and Pinterest, and we're all on all the good social media. But I am mostly on Facebook, so say hi on Facebook. That'd be wonderful. So today we're going to be talking about psychiatric drugs and psychiatry. Now, let me tell you a little story about why this is important to me. And a lot of people don't know this, but when I grew up in Canada, so we moved from Hong Kong to Canada, on my mother's side of the family, there's quite a history of so-called psychiatric disorders or problems. And my mom was diagnosed with major depression several times. She'd been on all sorts of medications off and on. We called it a nervous breakdown back then. And I think she pretty much, tried a whole bunch of different medications. And then she hated taking the medications. So, but we didn't like her when she was off the medications either, because she was, tearful and angry and all the things. So, and in our Chinese culture, sitting in a therapist's office is not something that is, considered okay. Like, you just don't reveal your skeletons, in the closet. So she went on these medications, and she would always go off of them, then she would get these horrible withdrawal symptoms, then she'd go back on it. And it wasn't until probably 10 years ago, having been on medications, relatively stable. I mean, she was never super happy. I mean, she could look happy, but not truly inside happy. I actually suggested, because she had some sort of weird hive problem, and I said, Mom, she said, what do I do with these hives? I said, well, I want you to take some probiotics, and I want you to try these, acupuncture patches, and because this liver point you put on your feet, it helps with itching. So she said, okay, I can do that. So she put these patches on religiously every day and took the, Probax religiously every day. And it took a little while, but the hives finally stopped. And she says, well, I'm going to keep doing this. I said, oh, really? And she said, yeah. She says, my depression's gone. I'm like, okay, heard that one before. And she goes, no, I feel better, and I'm not arguing with your dad as much. And I said, okay, look, here's the deal. Do not stop your medication suddenly like you've had in the past, because that was a disaster. You talk to your doctor about it, and you wean off slowly. I'd love for you to be off these medications, but you do it with help, not on your own. She promised she would do that, so she did. And it has been now, 7, 8, 9 years, however many years, she has been off medications. I mean, she still has her moments, but this is the longest time she's been without medications, and it was such a simple intervention that we used, and I can't say that, these patches of the probiotics cured her depression, but that it certainly did something to her body to help her body heal itself, and so she is so much better than it was. And I hear all the time about, people with PMS being told by the doctors they need to take XYZ medications. Or even more so, the children that I see, now I see a lot of, between the 14 and the 24-year-olds, and so many of them are what we call indigo kids. So they're extremely gifted and they're extremely sensitive. And it's like a snap judgment. It's like, oh, your kid's got ADD and you've got to be on medications. And so that's why the parents come to me. If their kid's lucky, the parents come to me and ask for help. And there's no question that some of the stuff that we do, it completely eliminates the need for having them on medications. But I'm hearing so many people say, oh, the teacher wants my child tested for ADD, and so many children on medication. So today's guest, Robert Whitaker, he is the author of Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. He's going to be with us, and this is exciting for me because here's someone who's really researched it from, now I see it from the clinical point of view, from one-on-one and my family and that kind of thing, but here's someone who's looked at the big picture overall, over the years, of what is going on. Why is the number of mentally so-called disabled people, why has it tripled over the past two decades? Thousands of children are added to the government disability rolls because they become newly disabled, and this is like an epidemic that's spreading rapidly among our nation's children. So exactly what is going on? So I'm going to ask Bob about, you know, the research from the last 50 years, and do psychiatric drugs really help? I mean, if you asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said, yeah, I mean, it did something. I mean, kind of numbed my mother out. She stopped crying and yelling at us, you know, but was she truly happy? Probably not. And so there's so many different ways now that I would approach the problem. But back then I was like, oh my gosh, stay on the Prozac, you know? Hopefully we'll hear about what kind of other solutions there can be besides drugs if that is not for our highest and greatest good. So, Bob Whitaker, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's a joy to be here.
Excellent. Well, how did you get to write this kind of book? Like, what is your background? Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I really came at this through a back door. So, I'm a journalist by background, and I worked for daily newspapers as a covering medicine and science for a number of years. And for a time, I was director of publications at Harvard Medical School. And I really had no interest in psychiatry, particular interest in psychiatry. I was just interested in medicine, medical developments. Anyway, in the 1990s, I sort of stumbled on some research with psychiatric patients that I thought was abusive. And it had to do different types of studies. One were studies where they were giving people with schizophrenia chemical agents designed to make them worse. The point was supposedly to study the biology of schizophrenia. And then there were studies in which they had withdrawn antipsychotics from schizophrenia patients, and I thought that was not good because my understanding was these drugs fixed a chemical imbalance. And then third, there were some the studies related to the introduction of new atypical antipsychotics, which were being heralded as these wonder drugs. And yet when I pulled the studies from the FDA, the FDA's reviews of these drugs, two things sprang out. One was that actually there was a real high death rate in those trials. About one in 145 patients who entered the trials died, but none of that was ever recorded in the scientific literature. And the second thing was that from the FDA's point of view, there was no evidence that these new drugs were any better than the old ones. So it was so out of – the FDA's review was so out of sync with what was being told to the public. And the FDA in its reviews also talked about how the trials had been biased by design against the old drugs and so forth. Anyway, so I did a series for the Boston Globe on abuses of patients in psychiatric research settings. And really wasn't going to do anything more than that series, except while doing it, I came upon a couple studies that really belied what I thought I knew to be true. And my understanding at that time related to schizophrenia was that we were making great progress in understanding the biology of this disorder, that it was due to too much dopamine activity in the brain, and we now had a drug, antipsychotics, that by lowering dopamine activity helped fix that problem, help bring dopamine activity back into balance. So I had that, and then that, and because of that, my understanding was that these drugs were absolutely essential for lifelong use, which is why in our series we wrote about how terrible it was to have conducted studies when they were in which antipsychotic medication was withdrawn from schizophrenia patients. However, at the end of the when that series appeared, I started doing further research, and here's the two studies that really began causing me to question what, quote, was conventional wisdom. One were studies done by the World Health Organization, which compared outcomes in three poor countries, India, Colombia, and Nigeria, with outcomes in the U.S. and six other rich countries. These are schizophrenia outcomes. And each time the outcomes they found were much, much better over the longer term in India and Nigeria than in the rich countries. They actually concluded that the difference was so pronounced that living in a developed country is, quote, a strong predictor. You won't have a good outcome if you're diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Wow.
And so after the first such study, which quite surprised the World Health Organization investigators, the investigators hypothesized maybe the reason for the better outcomes in the poor countries is that they are more medication compliant. They take their antipsychotic drugs more regularly. Now, that's a valid hypothesis. If the drugs are supposed to be so essential, then compliance should lead to better outcomes. But what they found was that in the poor countries where they had the best long-term outcomes, the drugs were only used primarily for acute episodes. In other words, they would use the drugs for a short period of time, but they wouldn't maintain patients on the drugs long-term. And in the poor countries, something like 16% of patients, only 16% of schizophrenia patients were regularly maintained long-term on antipsychotics. Where, of course, in the U.S. and other rich countries, that's the standard of care, just keep them on antipsychotics. So suddenly,
oh, yeah.
I had a finding that completely belied the conventional wisdom that continual antipsychotic use is necessary and helpful to schizophrenia patients on the whole. So that was one thing. And then the second thing was a study done by Harvard researchers who in 1994 reported this. Schizophrenia outcomes had actually declined in the last 15 years. They were not getting better. And they were now no better than they had been in the first third of the 20th century. That's from 1900 to 1933, when the therapies of the day were like putting people under heavy water streams, just non-medical responses. So this belied the story of progress. And that led me to write a book called Mad in America that really looked at, well, why is living in a developed country a strong predictor that you won't do well if you're diagnosed with schizophrenia? And what you find when you really dig into that is that there's been so much that our society, in a way, has organized itself around a false narrative. And, for example, we've been told that these antipsychotics fix known dopamine imbalances in the brain. Well, in fact, if you dig into the research, the cause of schizophrenia, the pathology, is still unknown. And they didn't find that, as a matter of course, people with schizophrenia had overactive dopamine systems. And then you can find that in long-term studies here, that actually unmedicated patients, time and again, had, on the whole, better long-term outcomes. Now, that doesn't argue for no use of the drugs. It really just argues for a selective use model. I'm talking about schizophrenia patients. And next thing you know, if you want to find the best outcomes for schizophrenia patients in the Western world, you go to Northern Finland, and that's how they use the medications. They use them selectively. There's some group of patients, they never put them on the medications, and they get better after 6 months, a year. There's another group of patients that use the medications for a period of time, like 6 months. And then there's only a small group of patients, about 20%, who schizophrenic patients, psychotic patients, who are maintained regularly on the drugs. So it's really a best-use model. My point is, though, going back to this first element of Mad in America, is when you really dig into the science and what's being found, you find that what is being told to the public and what is driving drug use protocols, it's just not supported by the science, and the science is telling something very different. Anyway, I wrote that book, and then my agent said, okay, Bob, psychiatry is a very controversial place. There's going to be a lot of people unhappy with you, and that certainly proved to be the case. So if you want to keep your career going forward, what you should do is now write about other subjects, less controversial. So I wrote a couple of other books, and that was fun. But then people kept asking me questions like, well, what's happening to the kids that are being placed on this medication? What's happening to them long-term? Do they provide a long-term benefit? And you mentioned about your mother being depressed. Well, okay, more and more people are getting antidepressants. So, for example, in 1980, there were Americans filled around 30 million prescriptions for antidepressants. That's 1980. Last year, we filled like 270 million, so a ninefold increase in the use of antidepressants. So is this increased use of antidepressants, is it helping reduce the burden of depression in our society? Or is it helping people do well long-term? Does it improve the long-term course of depression? So those are the questions I really wanted to address in the second book I wrote on the subject called Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. And what you find when you address this and really look at the science is do the drugs sometimes work over the short term in ameliorating a symptom? Yeah, that evidence is there. So you'll see that, you know, people with depression often get better for a period of time. You'll see people who are psychotic, often their psychotic symptoms abate. You'll see people with anxiety, their anxiety symptoms will be reduced. And it's that short-term perspective that leads us to declare, as in the Food and Drug Administration, to declare that these drugs are safe and effective. But then you want to ask, well, what happens to people over 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? And you want to say, does the drug treatment increase the likelihood that a person so diagnosed will have a good long-term outcome and be symptom-free 5 years later and will be functioning well as well? And what you find time and time again with, say, antidepressants and depression or really any of the drugs is you find that over the long term, the drugs increase the chronicity of the disorder, meaning the likelihood that, say, a person diagnosed with depression will still have depressive symptoms. And actually, they increase the likelihood that there will be some functional impairment developed. Now, again, that doesn't mean that nobody is doing well on the medications. These are just outcomes in the aggregate. And just to finish this story up, you were describing how your mother maybe was doing better, but on the other hand, she was really never doing well on the medications. That's a really typical course for someone treated with depression where it seems to work, but then it really isn't working, and they try many medications. And that's really a reflection of the fact that in science you do not see people going on a drug, a large majority, on an antidepressant, getting well and staying well for long periods of time. You don't see that in the science. So long-winded answer to say is this. I got into this subject out of a journalist's curiosity as to why living in a developed country would be a predictor you won't do well if diagnosed with schizophrenia. I just thought that was a tragedy and a mystery that was worthy of being investigated.
Wow. So, you know, most people will say, well, if the drug is approved by the FDA, there must be some evidence that it works. And we normally we were counseled in med school, and you'd find this very interesting, but I'm one of these people that love, you know, counseling people and comforting people. And so I'm there sitting with the manic depressive, you know, patient, right, just, you know, holding her hand and letting her cry on my shoulder, that kind of thing. And one of my other colleagues really couldn't stand psychiatry, but the teacher that we both had together, and we were like polar opposites, him and I, but the teacher was like, oh, Prozac was the newest thing that just came out on the market. So he was just like, you know, just kind of like tired of like what I was doing with this woman, and said, look, I'm just going to give her these medications. It's going to fix her, and just, you know, stop wasting your time. You know, this is a chemical imbalance. And we were told to tell patients they had a chemical imbalance. And so what you're saying is that, you know, in the studies that you have looked at, that yeah, there may be some short-term benefit, you know, symptom-wise, right, but long-term there really isn't anything that,
right,
not
in when you look at outcomes on the whole. May I ask you a question? When did you go to medical school? When were you told about the chemical imbalances?
Let's see. So I graduated in 94, so that would have been, yeah, like 91 maybe, something like,
yeah,
that, in the early
90s. This is
90s.
When the story was really being promoted. Here's the interesting thing about that. Say with antidepressants and you know, these new drugs fixed a chemical problem. In other words, that the idea was that depression was due to too little serotonin and the drugs fixed that. You really put your finger on why this whole paradigm of care needs to be rethought. And it really does come with the fact that we told ourselves, or American psychiatry, pitched a false story and managed to promote it. So if you look at the low serotonin theory of depression, if you go into the scientific literature, you find that it arises not from an understanding of what is going on in patients, people so diagnosed that they have low serotonin, but it begins with an understanding of how the drug acts on the brain. So an SSRI antidepressant like Prozac, what does it do? Well, when neurons in the brain communicate in this way, a presynaptic neuron discharges or releases serotonin into that tiny gap between neurons, which we call the synaptic cleft. That serotonin then binds with receptors on the receiving neuron, which we call the postsynaptic neuron. And now to end that messaging system, the brain has to have a way to remove the serotonin from that gap. And it does so by bringing it back up into the presynaptic neuron via reuptake channels. So what does a SSRI do, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor? It blocks that normal reuptake process. Serotonin now stays longer in that gap between neurons. You're upping serotonergic activity in that way. So once that was understood, researchers said, see, well, maybe then depression is due to too little serotonin. So this hypothesis actually goes all the way back to 1965. But when they found ways to begin to investigate serotonergic activity in depressed patients, in human patients, living patients, they very quickly began to find that there wasn't evidence that people with depression had low serotonin. And as early as 1983, the National Institute of Mental Health investigating this said, listen, we're just not finding evidence that there's a lesion in the serotonergic system that's a cause of schizophrenia. Keep going forward. Eli Lilly brings Prozac to market in 1988, and we really now start hearing this low serotonin theory. Prozac fixes a chemical imbalance in the brain. We can go and watch our TVs, and we see that if someone's depressed, they have too little serotonin, and then you get your antidepressant, and suddenly you're a happy face, and suddenly you're strolling on a beach with a beautiful person, and they've been fixed. Well, there's a couple interesting things on this. First of all, time and time again in the late 80s and 90s, they continued not to find that there was any problem with the serotonergic system. And in 1999, for example, in the American Psychiatric Association textbook, they reviewed this theory. This is in the American Psychiatric Association. Now, at this time, if you were to look at their literature, they were telling the public that these drugs fix chemical imbalances in the brain. But in their own textbook, it actually says, listen, this hypothesis didn't pan out. And frankly, it was sort of a stupid hypothesis in the first place because there's no reason that the pathology of a condition is going to be the opposite of whatever the drug does. That's in 1999. 2000, you can read Stephen Stahl saying, he writes a book called Essential Psychopharmacology. He says, listen, there is no real serotonin deficit. We didn't find it. And then my favorite sort of renunciation of this is from Ronald Pies, who's the former editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times. He says, listen, the idea of a chemical imbalance is a kind of urban myth, never a theory seriously propounded by well-informed psychiatrists. And what he's referring to there is that the theory had fallen apart in the 1980s. But here you are going to medical school in the 1990s, and you're being told that you can fix depression with a drug that fixes a chemical imbalance. Well, what you were being taught as a young doctor was a marketing slogan and not science, but it was being pitched to you as science, and that is the problem. Because now, if you actually dig into the science, we don't know the problem with depression. In other words, we don't know the biology of it. But what happens to your brain when you go on an SSRI? This is really fascinating, actually. So you go on an SSRI, which ups serotonergic activity, okay? Well, your brain, having all these feedback loops, now tries to adapt to the presence of the drug, the drug in accelerating serotonergic activity, and it does so by dialing down its own serotonergic activity. Its presynaptic neurons start putting out less serotonin than normal, and the postsynaptic neurons, the ones receiving this message, actually decrease the density of their receptors for this molecule. So the irony is this. When they investigated this, they did not find that people with depression had low serotonin prior to going on the drug, But afterwards, they did find that the drug drives the brain into a subserotonergic or a serotonergic desensitized state.
Mm.
And now, as people are looking at long-term outcomes with these medications and why they don't seem to have provided an enduring benefit, they're pointing to this compensatory adaptation, which they say the brain is trying to maintain a homeostatic equilibrium, as a reason for, A, why the drugs fail over time, lose their effectiveness, B, why it's so tough to get off them because your brain has adapted to their presence, and C, if you really look at the research literature, they're talking about how this drug-induced change can induce what they call a tardive dysphoria or a biological change that actually makes you more biologically prone to depression. So if you, it's a little bit like entering a Alice in Wonderland world where you start with certain beliefs and then you dig into the science and you see a whole different story. And once you understand that, you can see why the willy-nilly prescribing of antidepressant drugs with the idea that a chemical imbalance is going to lead to bad medicine because it's founded on a it's based on a false narrative.
Oh, I know, and I, you know, I have to say, I mean, I have to admit, I use that analogy, and there's so many people that have come to me with antidepressants that, of course, I'm a holistic doctor, so they want to get off of it. And I do what we call applied kinesiology of muscle testing, which is pretty woo-woo, you know, alternative stuff. But we've been able to get people successfully off the medication by literally talking on an energetic level to those receptors, to the brain, to say, look, we know you've downregulated these receptors and you have, you know, decreased sensitivity to these, you know, these neurohormones, these neurochemicals now, but we want to heal that, you know, and be able to slowly do that. And for some people, I mean, some people have tried like cold turkey and I look at them like, no, don't do that.
You see why cold turkey is a bad idea.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so they get into horrible withdrawal symptoms, which then makes them think I need the drug, which is so not true. But they don't realize it's that withdrawal symptom, not a depression or an anxiety issue. And unfortunately, I cannot, you know, certain people, I can't afford, you know, coming to see you because, you know, you're not a regular medical doctor. My insurance will cover the medications. It won't cover these other therapies. And so they'll end up with the medication. It's rare. I mean, people that come see me do that. But I always really tell them right up front, okay, this is what you're setting yourself up for. We can minimize the damage. But they're like, well, I just really, it's like, especially if they're young people and then they're taking, you know, being taken care of, and they don't have a say, so to speak. So the parent might say, you gotta get fixed. You know what I mean? You gotta get it fixed now. And so they'll offer the drug because that's what their other doctor says or their therapist says they need. And so I can't always win that battle on that, but it's been very enlightening hearing the research that you've been doing on it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's, I mean, sometimes the medical advice that's given in this field is just really pretty astonishing. The thing is, what's a bit amazing for me as a journalist is, I was quote, researching the scientific literature, which meant I was just reading the studies. And it doesn't take long to really find, I mean, it takes a while to really trace the history of this research and all, but it becomes pretty soon, as you trace the history of this, you know, investigation into the chemical imbalance theory, you see well-known people saying, well, it's just not panning out. I guess that theory has fallen by the wayside. And so you can see the betrayal here is that something like 80 or 87% of people now know that depression is caused by low serotonin. Well, that's data that tells of a population that was sold a false story. And it's just... you know, it's you know what it does besides causing for misuse of drugs, it prevents us as a society from really developing alternative strategies for helping people like your mother and others that are you know, struggling with their minds in this way. And there's plenty of evidence that there are other sort of effective strategies, starting with exercise, eating well, meditation seems like it can often help. Sometimes I think, as you say, having someone you can talk to can be quite helpful too. So that's part of the tragedy is we, began thinking we had magic bullets for depression, but we don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then maybe you can share with us a little bit about what you've researched on the younger kids, or even the older adults or kids that are now on the stimulants. My concern, although I haven't done the research, you have no time, but my concern is that, you know, stimulants are going to rev up that poor little adrenal gland. It's a stress symptom. And if you're revving your adrenal glands over and over and over again to produce these neurohormones, eventually they might poop out. So that's my concern about having someone on stimulants, whereas, you know, the change in the diet, the environment, the electromagnetic radiation that might be affecting them, you know, they're sleeping with their cell phone, they're taking an MSG or, you know, aspartame, which is a excitotoxin of the brain. All these different things can be done, but I'm just curious, like, what have you found in your travels?
Well, this is a great question because, you know, we began medicating kids with, diagnosing kids with ADD or ADHD in the 80s. And this launched a really quite an extraordinary experiment in which we would take younger people with developing brains and give them a chemical that altered rather profoundly how their dopamine system worked. And then with really not much thought about how this would affect them long term. You know, would it really help them grow up and thrive? So what you see when you investigate the research literature for stimulants is, first of all, methylphenidate or Ritalin works basically in the same way that cocaine does. It's just longer acting than cocaine. They both block the reuptake of dopamine such that you end up with, you know, dopamine staying in the synaptic cleft longer than normal and upping dopaminergic activity. And they do that with the same potency. So when we begin to question whether, Ritalin is good for kids, one of the way to conceive of this is to ask, is a daily dose of cocaine good for a kid? But what do you find in the research literature? Well, you do find that the drugs initially cause a noticeable change in behavior. The kids will talk less. They'll socialize less. They will move around less. and they can focus. They may focus almost in a obsessive way on certain tasks, like a whatever the task, like an arithmetic task, that sort of thing. But from the very beginning, when they tried to see if this translated into better scholastic achievement, they didn't find it to be so. They didn't find that this change in behavior led to better reasoning or that sort of thing. And then in the early 1990s, so we began doing this really in any sort of big way in 1980, and then in 1994, the National Institute of Mental Health mounted the first long-term study of stimulants or treatments for ADHD. And as they mounted that study, they said this: at this point, we have no evidence that medications, ADHD medications, produce a benefit, a long-term benefit, on any domain of functioning. They don't reduce aggressivity over the long term. They don't increase scholastic achievement. They don't increase the likelihood of a good social, job-earning achievement, that sort of thing. There's no evidence of any improvement on any domain of functioning. And this study, known as the MTA study, was meant to answer that question. Do these drugs provide a long-term benefit? Now, at the end of 14 months, the kids treated by experts in ADHD with medications were doing slightly better than those given behavioral therapy. They had a greater reduction of ADHD symptoms, and they might have been doing a little better on reading, too. So this was seen as finally there was evidence that the drugs provided a long-term benefit. And that is still, if you're a parent who gets a kid gets diagnosed with ADHD and you go to a website run by the American Academy of Child Psychiatry, you'll see, how do we know these drugs work long-term? And they'll cite the 14-month results from the study. Now, what they won't cite are the 3-year results and the 6-year results, because at the end of 3 years, medication use was a marker not of benefit but of deterioration. That's the words of the investigators. And by the end of 6 years, you saw that the medicated kids had worse ADHD symptoms, greater functional impairments, higher delinquency rates. In other words, they were all negative. And as one of the investigators, William Pelham, who's a psychologist, summed it up, he said it this way: We had thought that medications would provide a long-term benefit. That didn't turn out to be the case. Over the short term, it helped the kids behave better in class. But over the long term, it didn't provide a benefit on any domain of functioning. Now you have studies done in Australia, same thing, no benefit. There was a study done in Quebec. They found no long-term benefit. So what you see when you see a stimulant is over the long term, you see nothing on the benefit side of the equation, which means you just have to chalk up the risks, the possible harms. And the risks and harms are many. One of the first ones, and I'm not sure this fits in with your adrenal system change, but it might, is somewhere between 10%, even to 20% of all kids medicated with stimulants for a longer term now convert to bipolar. And, of course, once they convert to bipolar, they're treated with more often polypharmacy, and they're now seen as having a chronic lifelong illness. So what you see, one risk is you're going to take a kid who, you know, maybe is not doing great in school at age 6 or 7, and you're going to turn them into a lifelong bipolar patient. That's the biggest risk, I would say, but there's also risk that from animal studies and also some from human studies that this, you know, changing the dopaminergic system this way leads to anxious adults. It leads to less curious adults. It leads to adults that may have substance abuse problems. So there's a lot of, and also maybe that are not able to feel joy because of sort of the finished dopaminergic systems, and our dopaminergic system is the system that helps us. It's our reward system. So what you really see again in science is a diagnosis plus treatment that may help the kid behave better in class for a period of time, and that kid may do a little better in class for a period of time, but over the long term do not provide a benefit and expose the kid to all sorts of risks. And just to give you an example of this explosion of bipolar and of chronically ill kids, in 1987 we had 16,000 kids in the United States that were said to be disabled, kids from, you know, 5 to 18, said to be disabled by a mental illness. Today, and this begins to climb right along step with the use of stimulants. Anyway, today we have more than 800,000 kids so disabled by mental illness. And if you follow the kids that hit age 18, about two-thirds appear to go right on to adult disability. So what we have now in this era of widespread stimulant use is basically a new career path has opened up in American society in which kids get diagnosed with ADHD, a percentage of them move on to bipolar, and then they have a life as a mental patient stretching out in front of them.
Oh, wow. 16,000 to 800.
Yeah, that's not good.
Oh, wow.
And as you know, somewhere from 1995 to 2002, there was a 35-fold increase in the diagnosis of juvenile bipolar disorder. 35-fold increase in like 7-8 years.
Wow, that is amazing. And I haven't been in the medical school system teaching in quite a number of years now that I'm in a small town and have a small town practice. But do you know if any of this stuff is being taught in medical schools anywhere?
Not really, no, because of course, if you see where the teaching comes from, it comes from an academic psychiatry that in some ways has been bought by, you know, it's really shaped by guild interests, in other words, psychiatry's own interests, and of course the relationship among many academic psychiatrists to pharmaceutical companies, and they're quite hesitant to talk of harm done. There was a paper by Harvard researchers that looked at this and basically said we shouldn't be medicating kids for ADHD. At least we should be really cautious about it. And there was, in Spain, there's a big battle going on because researchers who actually had read, investigators who had read Anatomy of an Epidemic decided to do their own investigation of the literature, and they came up to the same conclusion. We shouldn't be using these medications except in a last case, and they should be the treatment of last resort and only for a shorter period as possible. And they said that our clinical care guidelines have to be completely revamped. So, but unfortunately, I'll tell you a quick story. This actually became an issue. The Vatican actually raised this issue, and they convened a panel on it, and they invited, are we harming these kids? And they convened a panel on it, and it was, you know, they invited me, and they invited some other people who had written about this. And you got two different stories. You had people who I thought knew the literature saying, look, at long-term, these are causing harm. And then you had a number of ADHD experts who really focused on short-term and said, oh, listen, we're helping these kids stay in school. But they didn't cite long-term stuff.
Mm. Wow. And so did the Vatican have some sort of conclusion after this meeting?
Well, you know what? They were supposed to produce a white paper on it, but politics apparently got involved, and there was some drug companies unhappy with the Vatican for even convening that meeting, and so no white paper ever came out, and that was the whole purpose of the meeting. It just got stunted.
Well, wow. Just to think that the Vatican would have, you know, that the drug companies would have any influence over the Vatican at all. I mean, this is, of course, from, you know, an innocent perspective.
But you know what it is, is that what came out is the Vatican, has various programs, say, in Africa, that one of its programs is providing, HIV drugs to poorer populations. And I guess they do that at a reduced rate they get a reduced rate for the drugs. And so there, the Vatican, it seems, is also vulnerable to political pressure that says, or corporate pressure that says, well, maybe you won't be getting these drugs at this good price any longer in the future.
Mm. Right, I see. Well, it seems to me, and Bob, you probably, you know, have come to a similar conclusion that so much of our prescribing is really we're not prescribing for the benefit of the child, we're prescribing for the benefit of our convenience, for what we think it should be, for the convenience of the teachers. And I come from a family of teachers, and I have the utmost respect for what teachers need to be able to do, and it is amazing what they do. And I'm a teacher myself, you know, my parents convinced me not to become a classroom teacher, but that's what I love to do the most, and I have great respect for teachers. So I'm not saying that they're lazy or anything like that, but the system is broken. And then parents, you know, two incomes, or they're overwhelmed, they're stressed, their parents are aging, getting sick, and there's all these responsibilities. And, you know, we live in a place where there's not a lot of support because they live hundreds and thousands of miles from the nearest relative. And so it's so much easier to go, oh my God, thank God there's a pill, you know, to feed my kid, rather than say, you know, well, I'm just going to take some time to cook some whole food meals. And no, you're not going to buy the Fruit Loops. I'm sorry. And, you know, put your foot down and say, this is not, you know, healthy. And I'm not feeding this stuff to you. But it takes time to make bone broth. It takes time to, you know, cook these meals. And, you know, the kid whines and wants their iPad and their whatever, and, you know, and have their cell phone. And I said to one parent, I said, you know what? We just tested that she is toxic from EMF cellular phones. And I said, do you pay for the bill? She said, yeah. I said, you pay for the cellular bill, right? Yeah. I said, here's the thing. You tell her this device, protection device, has to go on this phone, and you need to put this phone on airplane mode when you sleep at night, or you don't get a phone. And, of course, I'm not a parent, so I can't say how easy or hard that is. My husband said, oh, my God, you'd be so strict. I'm like, yeah, probably. I'm probably really strict. But it's that kind of thing that parents don't want to bother because it's, oh, they're already so stressed. They don't want to argue with their kids, you know?
You know, this is...
Give them the pill and have them quiet down.
My favorite part of this story is I have a friend who's a doctor, and he brings in the father and the son, and the son's got ADHD and is on a stimulant. So he turns to the kid and he says, well, how are you doing on this medication? Is it working? And the kid says, well, why are you asking me? The drug's not for me. It's for my father. Ask if it's working for him. The doctor just cracked up because he realized that is the case.
Yeah.
And, you know, you even mentioned it a little bit in your description of your mom. that sometimes she wasn't so happy with the meds, but you found that maybe her behavior was better for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even that even showed up a little bit. I mean, and this is certainly true with antipsychotics and that sort of thing. So we do want to ask who are we treating here? The other thing here is that you mentioned I thought was really interesting is diet with quote ADHD kids. You know, there was an experiment done in Appleton, Wisconsin some years ago in which they had a lot of kids diagnosed with ADHD and a lot of kids that were delinquent and a lot of problems. And what they did with a grant, I'm not sure where the grant came from, is they came into the school, a group of outside people, expert in diet and nutrition, and they remade the school. So they took out all the Coke machines, so you couldn't buy crap Coke. And then in terms of the cafeteria, they no longer served processed food, whatever is supplied by the government and that sort of thing, you know, with high, all that crappy food. But they began
right.
baking breads in the morning, serving fresh food, fruit.
Oh, I think I heard about this.
Yeah, so now all of a sudden they changed the diet. And they served a breakfast and a lunch, and they taught the kids on a school-wide basis how to care about their diet, how to eat properly. And
right, right.
And guess what happened? ADHD pretty much disappeared. And
yeah.
then all of a sudden you had healthy kids and healthy guts and all that sort of thing. So, but why didn't we, since that worked, why don't we have cafeterias like this, you know, across the country? Well, the point is...
Coke donates money to the RSA.
Yeah. The first one produces a profit. The second one does not. There's no corporation
yeah.
that's really going to make a huge amount of money by serving good food.
Right, exactly. And there are some grassroots, you know, all over the country and even in our school system, the co-owner of the natural food store has young children and they're trying to change the food system in the regular schools. They don't homeschool. There's many people that do, but they're really trying to change the system from within and getting parents together and teaching them, which is amazing that they put that effort in there. I didn't tell you, Bob, that the first documentary, health documentary that I watched that totally blew my mind was The Marketing of Madness. That I got free in the mail from the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. I have no idea why I got it free. It just showed up in the mail, and it was a free video. I said, well, I'll watch this movie, and I'm thinking, well, how bad could it be, right? How bad could psychiatry be? And, you know, I have friends that are psychiatrists, you know? My mother was on psychiatric drugs. So I'm watching this movie, and it's very loud and, you know, all this stuff. But when it got to the point where it talked about these, you know, psychiatrists that were brought to, you know, in front of Congress because of a tax evasion that had received millions of dollars from pharmaceutical companies, and it came out that their names were on these papers saying that these drugs work, and that they never wrote the paper, and they actually never did the research. They just
yes.
agreed
yes,
to put their name on it, and I got to tell you, was so shocked. I think I was in shock for I don't know how long after that. And I said, my colleagues did that? I am so ashamed. You know, it freaked me out.
Yeah, well, this is what happened. It's starting in the 80s and all. It's basically, and it's not unique to psychiatry. I mean, the problem became worse. It first appeared really so much in psychiatry. And it got worse in psychiatry, but it also affects, you know, other medical disciplines. And basically what happened starting in the 80s is the pharmaceutical company industry basically began, quote, capturing academic psychiatry. And they did it, one of the ways they did it is they just started hiring academic psychiatrist after another to serve as a speaker, advisor, consultant.
Right.
And be their thought leaders. And then in research studies, what you'd see happen is, you know, the drug company would design a study, and some of these experts would be seen as participating as investigators, but the investigators wouldn't design the study. They wouldn't analyze the data. They really would have nothing to do with it, and then the company itself would you know, have someone write up a report, and then these people who were being paid by pharmaceutical companies to be advisors would sign off as the authors. And what
yeah.
we now know is that, so that's ghostwriting, right? And what we now know
yeah.
is that this process led to, A, a spinning of results, a hiding of adverse effects, an exaggeration of positive findings, the non-publication of negative findings. It led in every way to a corrupted scientific literature, even on studies of the short term. And it's really quite clear what happened is we had an academic establishment that was, bought by the pharmaceutical industry, and that corrupted the knowledge base.
Well, I want to make sure people know how to get a hold of your book, and your website is robertwhitaker.org. That's spelled Robert, and then Whitaker is Whitaker.org for everyone that's listening in. And where can they get a copy of your books, Bob?
Yeah, by the way, in terms of the website that I run that has much more activity of this sort is called madinamerica.com.
Oh, great.
And that's actually a webzine on this whole topic. We have maybe 150 writers. We have news there. And you can find my blog there as well, but it's part of a larger webzine addressing this issue. And that's madinamerica.com.
Fantastic.
And a lot of science. You can do a lot of research there and find access to the studies. As far as where you can get my books, the easiest way, of course, unfortunately, in a way, is Amazon. But you can, you'll see different books that I've written there. So you can just go in and put Mad in America into Amazon, and I'll come up. Or you can put Anatomy of an Epidemic, and I'll come up. Or I have my most recent book, which is co-written, is called Psychiatry Under the Influence, which really reports on this complete sort of capturing of psychiatry. So that's the easiest way is, some of these books are still in bookstores, but the easiest way is just to go on to Amazon.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I see my colleague Kelly Brogan just wrote a blog, The Drug-Free Solution to Ending Depression. We had also interviewed her as well, and Hyla Kass, who's a psychiatrist and talked about the nutritional approach to some of these. So we've interviewed them. And so it's so great to have somebody like you having done this research. I just do not have time to look at
all
these papers.
But yeah, Kelly writes for us, and she does a great job.
She has her book is launching as well, A Mind of My Own, which is fantastic. We hope to have her back on the show to talk about her book. And so I so appreciate you being on the show today, especially, sometimes people need to hear it from other people. And like you said, you're a journalist. You're not necessarily a biased medical doctor or a medical doctor with something at stake for either one way or the other. You were just trying to look at, hey, what's really going on? And so I think it's really great there's people like you out there that's willing to do this kind of work. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, and thanks, everyone, for listening in. And our pleasure, mutual pleasure. Thank you so much. So madinamerica.com, everybody. Check out. There's some really great articles on there. And there's definitely, non-therapeutic solutions for those people who are willing and looking for those kinds of solutions. Thank you so much, and bye for now, everyone.